So, agricultural revolution occurs. For the first time in human history, human beings on a large scale are willing to experiment with food production. Why? Well, because of the new confidence that was circulating in Western civilization because of the scientific revolution and all of the evidence-based learnings in which they were engaging. I mean, after all, if you could establish the fact that the Earth revolves around the sun, and you could prove it scientifically, mathematically, and then you could experiment with things in nature, why could you not experiment with food? The consequence was they were able to produce food better, more efficiently, more profitably, which of course allowed for more human beings to live and not die of things like starvation. If it was not for the scientific revolution, there would not have been an agricultural revolution. And if there was not an agricultural revolution, there would not have been the industrial revolution. Why? Well, I covered it at the end of last class. They were able to produce more food using less land, which meant they had less need for labor. What are you going to do with the more people? In order to have factories, you need a labor source. Well, now suddenly you had a mass of unemployed people you could put to work. The farmers are also making tons of profit. And what do you do when you have lots of money? Well, when you get to my point in life, you invest it in businesses and allow that money to grow. So you had these large farm owners willing to use their extra money and invest in these new factories, which potentially could produce more products, allowing for more production of food. More, more, more. And by the way, the third outcome of the agricultural revolution was, again, that continued willingness to experiment, to take risks, to innovate. And by the way, that last one is the one thing that we as individuals do not do well. We don't take risks. Taking risks is not comfortable. Because if you take a risk and you fail, that means you lose. Most people don't have the testicular fortitude to take those types of risks, which could result in the complete destruction of whatever it is you're producing. But during this time, people are like, why not? Why not? Let's risk it all. And as a result of this, you started seeing on small incremental steps the slow and gradual shift from the way we used to produce things with these 10 digits to machine manufacture, where machines were producing goods. And just as innovations like crop rotation and using clovers and turnips, you know, allowed for more food to be produced more per acre, the moment you started making things out of machines, I mean, do you ever watch the History Channel? It's like how things are made. And like they show you like the conveyor lines of just like how to bottle soda. And it's just like, foom, 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 foom. You can't even see the cans going by that. You know, they go by so quick. Supply and demand. The more goods you produced, the cheaper things became, and the higher standard of living was experienced. Now, here is the one thing that makes the Industrial Revolution interesting. Human beings had been doing basically the same things for hundreds of years, all over the earth. There were civilizations that rose, that did great things, and then fell. But the one thing that they never did was automate. Until Europe did it. Now, why Europe?
Is it because the white race is somehow superior?
No.
What it was, as a result of everything that we've talked about since the beginning of the semester and going back further, the seeds that would allow for the Industrial Revolution to take place began to bloom. One. By the 17th and 18th century, because of the aggressiveness of the Europeans during the Age of Exploration to essentially travel the globe to get products and sell, more money was being produced. And wealth was spread out through more classes. Yes, you had the nobles that had money, but most of their money was tied up in real estate. But soon you had the merchants, the businessmen, that started making cash. And then you had all their sailors who were making cash. And they were taking that cash and they were spending it. Trickle-down economics. And then in the stores and the shops that they were spending their money, suddenly the storekeepers had money. And guess what they did? They spent it as well. Labor was paid for. More people had cash in their pockets. And they just spent it. And as a result, wealth spread slowly, gradually, allowing a base of the people, a majority of the people, to at least have something. Compare that what's going on elsewhere in the world at the same time. In most of the world, you still had peasants who were owned like slaves by their landlords. And the only thing they got paid was a portion of the food that they raised. Maybe they got a house, a little hut to live in. But that was about it. But Europe, they had folded money and they wanted to spend it. Also in Europe, because of things that we really didn't get into that much, but we touched upon it during the Renaissance, there already was a pre-existing infrastructure for production. Things were handmade, though. You had the proverbial, how does it go? The candlestick maker, the baker, the something, the candlestick maker. I don't remember how that goes. But you had people making things. You had seamstresses. You had carpenters. You had jewelers. You had people who made houses, people who made walls, miners, sappers, engineers. But you also had bankers. You had lawyers. All of that stuff was in place. You also had existing markets that were connected by trade routes. And you had a demand for those luxury items. So if someone was willing to risk their life, get on a boat, sail halfway around the world, fill up their boat with crap, and sail it back, they could unload it. They could sell everything and make profit. And you had a network to guarantee profitability. There were banking houses that you could get loans for. There were insurance companies. So you could put insurance on your boat just in case something catastrophic occurred. And you also had the emergence of chartered companies, joint stock trading companies. So people could basically jointly own a company and get a share of the profits. You also had expansion. Europeans were some of the few people who ever went global and expanded their control. When you look at all of the other empires that have ever existed, it was always done through border expansion. Country A would invade country B, conquer it, and absorb it. The Europeans, they went to the New World. They went into Asia, they went into Africa, and they were making settlements filled with their people. And those people would produce commodities that would be shipped back to the mother country. And they served as willing trading partners. So they bought whatever was made. Resources, markets, boom. There's your money. And most importantly, the government supported this expansion. There was no socialism. There were no Democrats trying to tax and regulate everything. There were kings. And the kings were in competition with one another. They wanted more. So they willingly allowed anybody in their empire, so long as they got a license, to go anywhere and do anything to make more money. Because the crown knew, the moment one of my merchants finds a new contact, gets some new commodity, brings it back, we can tax it. Which means the crown can make more. So they not only allowed it, they encouraged it. And they tried maximizing profitability for the risk takers to ensure that incentive was there. Again, all you got to do is think about the people who got on those wooden boxes, sailed across the Atlantic Ocean, and founded Jamestown, or founded Plymouth, or Massachusetts Bay. Why on earth would they get on a boat and risk their lives to go to some godforsaken place with no civilization, only woods and trees and little fuzzy animals that will eat you, and a whole bunch of barbarian natives who want to kill you? Why would they risk it? It's all about the Benjamins. Because the government essentially said, you can make whatever you can make. Just give us a taste. So it's no coincidence that Europe, beginning around the age of exploration, started per capita enjoying more money, more profitability than anywhere else on Earth, at a higher clip pace than it was seen anywhere ever. Questions? And notice, it had absolutely nothing to do with the fact that they were white. Actually, white people aren't really white, we have to be honest. If you are of a European descent, you are kind of peachy. Unless you're like me, I got Italian in me, I got really dark in something. All right. Now, of the European countries, the first country to industrialize was England. Why England? Well, England had added advantages above all of Europe. The first, bless you, was the fact that there was not an absolute monarchy. As we saw with the rise of William and Mary, they willingly, in the English Bill of Rights, essentially fully ceded their ability to legislate. They essentially became figureheads, which meant Parliament, full of elected officials, would be in charge of making the laws. And here is something that will chill some of you to the core. Politicians are sleazeballs. They always put loopholes in the law that they can exploit. Why do you think people like Joe Biden and Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell or Barack Obama or any of these people who go down to Washington, D.C., you know what they make to be in Congress? They make like $180,000. How is it that they can go down there and come back being multimillionaires? Well, they're all corrupt. They're all slime balls. They're all taking advantage of the loopholes they put in the laws. Well, guess what? Parliament was doing the same thing. They wanted to allow everybody to go abroad because they would all make money off the deal. So what did they do? They practiced laissez-faire capitalism. Laissez-faire. Anyone ever heard of that phrase before? We'll talk about it when we do the Enlightenment. What does it mean, real quick?
It's like very hands-off.
Hands-off. So you want to go start a business? You go start a business. You take the risk. You make all the money you can.
Government will get out of your way.
So they freely granted licensing, charters. They passed laws to protect private property. And they basically encouraged people to go become fabulously rich. Plus, England had high quantities of easily accessible iron and coal deposits. Guess what all machines are made out of? They're made out of metal. Why are they made out of metal? Can you make a machine out of wood? Well, you probably could, but what's probably going to happen to it when it starts heating up? Yeah, it's going to catch on fire. And by the way, originally everything was steam powered. And steam was fueled by coal. So the fact that they had the commodity to make the machines out of and the fuel source right there, it's common sense. By the way, that's the reason why we became the king of the automobiles. Because not only did we have iron in our country, but we also had oil reserves, and we still do. Although before there was automobiles, the only way to get goods from point to point was either by putting it in an ox-pulled carriage or putting it in a backpack. Neither would result in tons of goods being moved, unless you put it on water. And England is crisscrossed with navigable rivers that have quick access out to the Atlantic Ocean. Which means you could put tons of goods on a barge, sail it downstream, go out into the ocean, and sail it anywhere on the island. Easily. Cheap. Low costs. Oh, and by the way, because they were an island, the England were used to using boats. Going all the way back to the Anglo-Saxon period, England had become a nation of maritime experts. So moving things by water, no big deal. And lastly, England was the first nation to do the closed field. The landlords were trying to maximize profitability. So they figured out what was their land, and then they realized, we don't need all these dirty, stinking peasants. They literally got kicked off the farm. Some came over here, but most went to the urban centers looking for work. Oh, and by the way, you know what would happen in England if you didn't have a job? I wish we would do that in this country. Well?
You'd be sent as an, you'd be sent away.
Well, yeah, because you would go into debtor's prison. You would actually be locked up. And then you know what would happen to you once you were locked up? Ship captains would come and basically clear out the jails. And they could take you anywhere in the world and sell you off. That's the reason why there actually were white slaves in the North American colonies. Because anytime the jails got too full, fill up a ship, bring them to America, sail them off. Mostly it was the Scotch-Irish that suffered that fate. Why? They had more bodies than jobs. Which meant labor was cheap. Right. They also had a commodity ready to go to industrialize. Wool production. Wool is, in one sense, awesome. The oils in the wool are naturally resistant to moisture. If you wear a wool sweater, yeah, the outside gets moist, but the inner layers always stay dry. And that was very important because
of the climate in the British Isles. Any of you ever go to England or Ireland? The best way, if you've never been there, that I can describe it is it's gray. Most days the sun doesn't come out, and at some point it's going to be high humidity, but it's going to be cool, and it's going to be damp. Heck, I think when the last time I went to Ireland, I think we were there for a week, I think it rained like every day except for one. Not big rain, but just kind of like this, just kind of like damp and just kind of gross. So wool, perfect, perfect commodity to make clothes out of, because you can't run around in the British Isles naked, because you get pneumonia. And the nice thing about wool, unlike what we have today, is if wool comes apart, it's easy to weave it back together again. Whereas with the clothes that we now, some of it's cotton, but a lot of it's synthetic. If this rips, it's very hard to repair. Plus, the animal that wool comes from, sheep, they do fine in the climate and the conditions that exist in the British Isles. They can eat anything. A lot of the natural grasses over there are very acidic. And other animals like cows, they really can't digest them as efficiently. But you put sheep out there, they can go up in mountains, rocks, they can find anything and they'll eat it all, like goats. So they raised sheep, they had the wool, they had been making clothes out of wool, and everything was ready to go. Oh, one other thing. England had also made global contacts, going back to the Renaissance. We already talked about the putting out system that existed in Florence. Where do you think the Florentine producers got their wool from? England. So it was just a matter of time of taking the system that had developed in Florence and basically making it domestic, which occurred sometime over the 14th century, the 1300s. And we did the put-out system, pretty straightforward. Merchant goes out to the farmer, buys the raw cotton, and then goes from different little cottage businesses, each step individually doing one of the many steps necessary to take the raw wool and making it into weavable thread. So we're talking the scouring, the carding, the spinning, etc. All done, cottage industry. And at the end, once the merchant runs the cotton through, he ends up with bolts of finished cloth that he then can take it to the marketplace and sell. Because, by the way, there were very few clothing stores back then. It was typically the ladies of the household that made everyone's clothes. But if you are growing, barley or wheat, you probably don't have many sheep. So at least this way you could take your barley, go to market, trade it, and get bolts of cloth that you could bring home, and then your wife could make your clothes out of it. All of it was there. Every single step was in operation. The only hiccup was everything was done with these. Human power. And as I'm sure you all know, we as machines are not overly efficient. We get tired. We get sleepy. We get sick. And heck, we break real easy. So ultimately, the amount that was being produced was not at the levels of the demand. Supply was low, prices were high. The biggest kink in the system? A weaver, someone who took all the threads and weaved it into the bolt of the cloth.
needed 4 to 5 spinners spinning the threads. But there were not enough spinners, so production was low. Why? Well, have you ever seen a spinning wheel? You take kind of like the fibers that have been kind of stretched out, and you put it on a machine, and you have to hand crank the wheel. It takes a lot of physical effort. And if you put too much force, you break it. So you have to do it just right. So the goal was, all right, well, if we need to produce more wool, because we have markets, we have population, we have customers. If we need to produce more wool, we have to figure out how to spin more thread. In comes innovation. People willing to experiment. 1733, a man by the name of John Kay invents a little device that will allow the weaving machines to get bigger. And it's a seemingly innocuous device. Heck, I went down to an antique store down in Uxbridge, Burnett Mills, with my wife over the weekend, and there were like 3 booths that had these kicking around. This little canoe-like thing, that's called a flying shuttle. This little device would allow cross-stitching. Because again, if you look at the fabric, it's some going horizontal, some lines going vertical, and it's basically cross. Well, previously, with the looms that made the bolts of cloth, you could only make it about as long as a person's arm. Because what you would have to do, you can see on this graph here, you would basically, by hand, have to weave your cross thread up and down, up and down, up and down, all of the lines. And that took time. But John Kay invented this little canoe, which rested on a track, that when you used a foot pedal, it would allow you to basically open up every other thread, creating the open space. Then you smack the flying shuttle across, there's your cross stitch, and then you hit the foot pedal, and it inverses the weave, essentially trapping it in place. This simple little boat doubled the amount of cloth that could be woven per day. And that made the imbalance even worse. Because now the weavers are able to produce twice as much. But you still don't have more thread being spun. So prices began to actually go up even more because the demand was increasing, but the supply was diminishing. Thirty years later, another inventor steps up, aiming at trying to stop the imbalance. A man by the name of James Hargreaves would invent a device called the spinning jenny. What this device did was combine 8 spinning wheels into one machine. And instead of it being hand-pulled, you had a crank. And you can see the lines. I don't know if you can see it in the back, but there are the 8 different grooves for each of the threads. So instead of one person pulling the spinning wheel, making one spool of thread, now suddenly you had somebody with a single crank could be working 8 machines at the same time. And to make matters even better, because of the hand crank, you could put more torque into it, which could allow for better stretching of the thread, which meant the thread was more durable. And last but not least, it could be powered by a woman. Whereas the spinners traditionally were men, because everything needed force. This had the torque in it. Now, I hate to break it to you. It's biology. Men generally are more stronger than women. More strength. We're just built that way. But when you could put a woman doing a man's job, that meant you could use the man and have him do other things. Because the women previously were not really working. So if you were a dad and you had a whole bunch of daughters, instead of training them all how to cook and clean, you can now send your girls off to work. And they could make some money to help the well-being of the household. And it wasn't as physically demanding. So, twice as fast production times 8 threads, which means you're now producing 16 times as much thread per day, and you can pay the woman less. Yes, girls and kids, back before there were child labor laws, kids went to work as well. If you've ever gone up to Lowell, up to the factories up in Lowell, go on the museum tours, they talk about this stuff. I'm not making it up. Well, now production costs plummet, thread output spikes, you have the more weaving capability, suddenly clothing becomes cheaper. Plus, one last little footnote. By this time, cotton is coming in and being stretched in addition to wool. But still, everything still has to be done by human power. Well, when word of this spreads, another inventor by the name of Richard Arkwright said, what happens if we remove the human component altogether? What happens if we attach the spinning wheel to a water wheel? Well, if we attach the spinning wheel to a water wheel, then the thread can be made automatically. Which means you can eliminate the woman and put a child in and pay him even less. This little candy-dandy contraption is essentially a spinning wheel, but this is the after item that was connected by pulleys to a water wheel, a device that would become known as a water frame. It could only do one thread at a time, but the water power was more constant. Even with someone cranking on the spinning jenny, you might put a little more force as you're coming around, or maybe put a little more force when you're pushing it away. With the water wheel, it's constant pressure, which means you're eliminating the weak spots in the thread. The thread is stronger and faster. Oh, and you know the best part? A water wheel doesn't need a poo-poo or a pee-pee break. A water wheel does not need sleep. A water wheel does not need food. Question? Yeah.
What year was that invented?
1771. Then just 7 years later comes the game changer. The spinning mule. This device was a spinning wheel that combined 48 spinning wheels. This mule had 48 spindles, produced in one going 48 spools of thread. It was capable of producing 1 pound of thread per day. And it was attached via the water frame to a spinning wheel, which meant it was automated. More production, cheaper costs. Cost of clothing goes down, makes it more affordable to even the poorest people who have jobs. Now suddenly, even poor people can start buying nicer clothes. And then comes automation with weaving. You've automated spinning. Now you're going to automate weaving. Just 3 years after the spinning mule was made, the power loom was invented. Also by Edmund Cartwright. This eliminated a human being altogether. Look, there's your cross channel for your flying shuttle. Everything is on, powered by the water wheel. Everything is boom, 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 boom. Bolts of cloth can be made meticulously at quantities unimaginable. I think it was 100 times faster than a human being. Brilliant device. And by the way, all weaving machines today are based on that item. But he screwed up. And this should be a lesson to all of you, if any of you aspire to be inventors. Guess what he never did? He never got a patent. So as a result, the moment word spread of what he made, so many people went down to his factory, checked it out, made mental notes, and then went back and they started building it. So even though he invented it, he would die impoverished because he never got a patent. All right, now you have automation. You have the ability to mass produce. The next imbalance that they would have to deal with was the resources. Sheep were not growing enough wool to feed these machines. Cotton was costly, expensive. So much so, a lot of the plantation owners in the British colonies prior to the Revolution thought about getting out of the cotton business altogether. They were not making any money on it. And those attitudes continued after the War of Independence and the creation of the United States of America. Until one last device. Made by Eli Whitney, who was born right down the road in Hopkinton, Massachusetts. He invented a little contraption that was known as the cotton gin. See, cotton is a flower, and when it blooms, it has seeds and fibers in it, and it's labor-intensive to pick, but it's even more labor-intensive to go through the fibers and pull out all of the non-cotton stuff. But with this device, you could simply drop the clump in these series of metal blades and levers, essentially extracted all of the non-fiber from the cleaners. Actually, this is the dirty stuff because you can see all the seeds and contaminants in there, and that's the clean stuff. Well, the consequence of this was one person using one cotton gin could clean 50 pounds of cotton in a day. This device allowed cotton to become profitable. So, prior to the invention of the cotton gin, 1790, the United States was only exporting about 3,100 bales of cotton. Not much. But fast forward to 1830, 731,000 bales of cotton. And just before the dawn of the Civil War in 1860, the United States was exporting approximately 4.2 million bales of cotton. By the way, that's one of the things that contributed to the expansion of slavery in our country. And two, that's one of the reasons why the South believed that they could win the War of Secession. Or actually, as they called it, the War of Northern Aggression, which we call the Civil War. Because they believed in the power of King Cotton. What all this did was make clothing affordable. And if it were not for these devices, you could not have a closet full of clothes. You probably would have inherited from your dead grandparents maybe a nice suit and maybe some work clothes that your mother would be responsible for patching and maintaining. And chances are you would pass your clothes on to your kids, who would pass it on to their kids, and so forth. Questions?
Oh.
Well, this still required all of these separate operations to be at different locations. Well, that was until one inventor brought all of the different steps of clothing production and put it out literally under a single roof, giving birth to what today we call a factory system. Coincidentally, the first factory was owned and operated by the same guy who invented the water frame. And this is a picture of it, this building right there. That's the original structure, although they added on to it. That is the mill at Cromford, Derbyshire, on the River Derwent, which is north of London. In this structure, Arkwright built spinning mules, power looms, all of the devices, and connected it to water wheels, which basically meant you could bring a wagon up to one door of all of the raw cloth, or the raw fabric, whatever it's going to be, wool or cotton, and then let it go through all the steps and processes, and it came out as finished cloth out the other door. This factory was huge because this was the first business operation to operate by a clock, not sun up to sun down. Why? Well, the water wheel didn't need brakes. So there were actually two shifts that worked 12-hour shifts, 6 days a week. One shift would come in around noon and work to midnight, and then the second shift would come in at midnight and work to noon. Why? Because you could put lighting in there. Not only was this the first business to operate by clock, but it also was the first business to pay people wages through what today we call at-will employment. Basically, you didn't get a contract. You were paid hourly, and you worked so long as the boss wanted to keep you employed. But the moment you screwed up, out the door you went. This was a huge operation. And soon, Arkwright's cloth began flooding the markets. But as innovative as this was, it still had one significant limitation. In order for a mill to be powered by a water wheel, where did you have to build the mill? But not just water. You needed to have a river. And what type of river?
A flowing river.
You had to have a river that consistently flowed just right to power the water wheel. Because guess what would happen to the water wheel if it was too gentle of a flow? It might not move. And what happens if it was too fierce? Could break. And then what happened to rivers in the wintertime? We've got to freeze. And what happens if it's a dry summer? The river may stop having water in it altogether. So while putting factories along rivers was a great idea, there was still one last innovation that could overcome even that limitation. And that would be with the advent of the steam engine. In 1768, I don't even know why I put it in front. In 1768, James Watts, who was a Scottish inventor, was tinkering around with early primitive designs of steam engines, particularly in the mining area, northern England into southern Scotland. They had been mining, they had been pulling coal out and iron out for centuries. But because England was an island, if you dug too deep, you went below the water table and the mines would flood. So in the late 1600s, there were some random unknown innovators that had developed kind of early pumps to help drain the water out. Well, the problem was they did not work, they were not efficient, and they had a tendency to break. In comes James Watts. He takes all of these pre-existing designs and does a couple of things.
Here we go. Here's the piston. So you can't really see it up here, but this is the piston. And up there is a sleeve. And as the piston powers, that's what creates the torque that allows the engine to drive things. Well, the problem was, is because this was the thing that was moving the most, this was the thing that heated up more and had a tendency to break. So what does he do? Well, he puts a sleeve, an insulating sleeve around the piston, allowing it to absorb more heat. He also separates the chambers from where the steam pressure builds from where the fire is, allowing a flow which produced more force. And he made his steam engine with standardized replaceable parts, which meant if something broke, you didn't have to throw out the whole steam engine. You could simply take off broken part, put new piece on. Well, as a result of his tinkering, his steam engine was 5 to 10 times more efficient than anything that had come before it, and it used less coal because more heat was contained. So, as he continued to expand, he began selling these. And a lot of potential mill owners were liking this because the prices along the rivers had been going up. But now you could build a steam-powered factory anywhere. Steam-powered would replace water wheels. Male labor would continue to be replaced by women and children. And production increased exponentially. The only limit was the size of the engine. So how do you make a better engine?
Well, you need better metal. At the same time Watts was tinkering, there also was a series of experiments that were going on with metal production, which would allow England to go from producing crap iron to more durable iron, which made it less likely to break or to explode or rupture. But to get better metal, you need better heat. In comes Abraham Darby. He owned a coal mine. But he began experimenting with taking coal and producing charcoal. This was originally called coke. Basically, what you do is you superheat the coal and it dries all the liquid out. And as long as you cut the heat source quick enough, you'll get the hard chunks, these blocks that you could put on a fire like you do if your parents cook with charcoal. Basically, once you light it, it heats up hotter, but it lasts longer because all of the moisture has already been eliminated. Well, he realized that if you use this coke, you could produce a hotter, more consistent flame. And that was important because of how metal's made. Metal is mined by miners going underground and finding rocks that have little blots of the iron that they're looking for, which then have to basically be crushed and put into a furnace, because iron liquefies, whereas all of the other minerals don't. So in order to end up with workable iron, you have to remove all the impurities. So by using coal, Darby was able to produce better iron. And throughout his life, he continued to experiment, and those experiments were taken up by his son, Abraham Darby II. Darby kept tinkering on blast furnaces and started trying to make better coal, and the end result was he had a blast furnace that could superheat the raw iron, allowing him to produce workable metal from what used to be called junk. It was called pig iron. This was the iron that had so many impurities that they just couldn't remove it. So basically, you would put the rock in, and if you couldn't get everything out, you just pretty much dump it all out. All around England, there were these huge slag piles of this metal that people couldn't use. Until Darby figured it out. Better furnace, better contained heat, better heat source. Well, you can use even the crap metal. Coincidentally, it would be Darby who would contract with Watts and would make the first interchangeable parts. And then the last big innovation in terms of iron production came in 1784, when Henry Cort would invent what is known as the two-compartment blast furnace. Simply put, this would allow for all of the rocks to be contained in a unit that, once heated, it will allow the liquid iron to bubble up to the top and all of the impurities to sink to the bottom. Once it was liquefied, you would blow a slight blast of air, which would allow for the liquid steel to flow. And at each of these two points, there were more and more catch bins to catch some more of the finer impurities.
allowing in the end almost pure iron to pour out at the end, which would then be rolled. If you see a modern steel producing factory, all of the steel, once it's produced, it's always in rolled bars. Because as you roll out the liquid metal, that basically forces more air out and allows it to cure more consistently, avoiding all of those microfractures. Now at the end, what does all this mean? Well, by the 18th century, England was producing massive steam engines capable of powering even bigger factories. Which meant no matter what industry you attached one of these machines to, they could produce more, more, more. Questions? The only thing that slowed them down was movement, transportation. Well, what happens if you take one of these steam engines and you put wheels on it? As they were working on producing stronger engines, more powerful engines, they were also figuring out a way how to apply this steam power to transportation. And they had something in place. Again, going back in time, England had mining operations, and one of the ways that the miners took whatever minerals they mined and got into the elevators to bring it above the surface was with little primitive carts that used wooden tracks that eliminated the friction, which allowed people to pull the carts with more and more weight. Well, the rails eliminate friction. You already have the method. Well, what happens if you power the wheels with an engine? That's how trains were invented. The first train was patented by Watt, who literally took one of his engines and put wheels on it. And what did it do? Nothing. It blew up. But that didn't stop people from working on it. And 20 years after Watts patented his first train, another train was invented by Richard Trevithick. That was known as the Puffing Devil. Why? Well, chukun, 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 chukun. The sound of the piston firing, powering the window, you know, sounded like an evil beast, and occasionally you'd hear the blast of the steam being released. But notice, this first device didn't run on tracks. It actually had thick wheels that would allow it to drive on regular roads. But the problem was it was heavy, and none of the roads were asphalt. So it had a tendency to go forward a foot or two and then just kind of stop. Fast forward to 5 years later, when George Stephenson invented his rocket by using iron rails, standard gauge, that the train had specialized wheels to slot into. This rocket was the first man-made invention to travel faster than 30 miles an hour. It could reach a maximum speed of 38 miles per hour without a load. But the moment he proved how fast it could go, let's keep building.
beginning in the 1830s, hundreds of miles of railroad lines were being built, not only in England, but also in the United States, connecting cities, allowing for mass transportation. By the 1850s, American and British companies were building railroad lines in Brazil, in Chile, in Canada, in India, in Australia. And by the post-Civil War years, we linked the continent with the first transcontinental railroads. And everywhere soon we're building railroads. But that's great. You can get the stuff from the country to the cities, but how can you get the stuff in the cities globally? Well, you do the same thing with ships. Let's put a steam engine on a boat and allow it to be steam powered. Well, the first steamship was actually made in America, 1763. William Henry. He got a replica of Watt's steam engine, put it in a boat, but the engine was too heavy, so the boat sank. The first successful boat that worked was the top picture. That was a boat built by the Marquis Claude de Joffre in France. His boat was called the Pyroscaf. And it was documented that a lot of the hoity-toity French nobles were astounded one day when he goes sailing by in his boat on the River Somme. They had never seen anything like it. The chunk, 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 chunk of the engine and the splashing of the little water wheels. And it just kind of moved along opposite to the flow of the river. Again, I could not imagine being alive and seeing something like that for the first time. But soon, just like with trains, more innovation was had, and boats became bigger because the engines that were put in the boats were bigger and allowing for bigger paddle wheels. And that process continued to the point when steam-powered ships were capable of sailing the globe, replacing wind power. But we're not going to go much beyond that because we can't go into the 19th century because we stop at 1800. But I do got an interesting last little bit. Why was it just England? Why didn't everybody else, the moment they heard what the English were doing, jump into this game? Well, truth be told, others did try to follow. But there were events that took place in Europe that disrupted development. The biggest thing was war. We don't have time to cover it, but if you look at European history throughout the 1700s, every couple of years there was another war. From the wars of the Austrian Succession to the Seven Years' War to the big wars like the wars of the French Revolution. All of these wars took place on the continent, disrupting life as we know it, but didn't occur in England. Throughout the 18th and into the 19th century, not a single war took place in England. So England was able to go through this innovation undisturbed. Plus, England was doing to the world markets what China was doing before Trump. Basically flooding the markets with cheaply produced crap. So cheap that no one could compete with. So in order to build a factory, you need money. In order to get money, you need capital. You need profits. But if you don't have a mean to make the profits, how can you ever make a factory? British goods were cheap. British goods were everywhere. And the British constantly reinvested their profits, allowing for slow, meticulous growth. On the continent, they lacked the capital. And by the way, they still were relying upon peasant labor, particularly in agricultural production.
And because England had been doing it for so long, they continued to innovate. By the time Europe was ready to industrialize, post-Napoleonic Wars, England was decades ahead of everybody else. And unlike what happened when Bill Clinton was president, and he leaked all of our industrial secrets to the Chinese in exchange for campaign donations, the Brits made it illegal for their data, their information, to be leaked. Up until 1825, it was illegal for a British engineer or mechanic to leave the country. They actually checked your employment. If you worked in making these machines or if you worked in factories, you could not leave. You were denied a passport. And until 1843, they made it illegal for British manufacturers to sell the machines. But wait, if that's the case, how the heck did we have an industrial revolution around the same time? Because of one man. Samuel Slater, who was known to history as the father of the American Industrial Revolution. He was British. And at a young age, he became an apprentice. And he worked in one of the mills as a machinist. He happened to have a photographic memory. He memorized the designs for all of the factory machines. The water frame, the spinning mules, the power looms. And then, at 21, he decides, I don't want to live in England anymore. So he fakes his identity, sneaks on board a ship, and sails to these United States of America. Then right down the road in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, in 1793, he opened his first mill, which is still there. And if you went to high school in the Blackstone Valley, you probably took a field trip down there. Because that would be an exact duplication of the mill that was built by Arkwright, down to the water wheel. Slater then began making so much money producing cheap American fabric, he would open 13 other mills up and down the Blackstone River. There was a mill in Webster, there was a couple down in Lincoln, Rhode Island, there was one in Uxbridge, all up and down the Blackstone. I think there was actually even one in Worcester. So when you talk about the Industrial Revolution, this area, the Blackstone River Valley, is the birthplace of the American Revolution. I mean, American Industrial Revolution, because of this man. But eventually, post-Napoleonic Wars, the secrets would begin to get out there, and others began to borrow British methods. Other engineers would sneak out, they would get high prices. Sometimes there were just outright instances of blackmail and bribery. But in the end, the Industrial Revolution would eventually spread to the rest of the European continent. But it would be a tool that the European governments would use to control the world. Because the governments realized more, if they could promote industrialization, they could increase the amount of money in their economies to levels where the sky is literally the limit. So, when France began to industrialize, in Spain, in the German states, and in Italy, they had a goal of basically competing. they were trying to catch the British. They also began implementing tariffs. Oh, tariffs are in the news. Tariffs are in the news a lot. Why is the president using tariffs? What's a tariff? What goods?
Imported goods.
Imported goods. And why do you put tariffs on imported goods? Well, you're going to make money, right? Exactly. Every single thing comes off the boat has a tax on it. Plus, if you put high enough tariffs on it, you're going to protect your domestic production. You're going to insulate it from foreign competition. Nations during this time also made trade agreements. Oh, what also the president is working on redoing. You know, the United States hasn't redone its trade agreements on a global level since the end of World War II? That's the reason why everywhere on Earth uses tariffs against us. Well, last count I heard, up to 134 nations want to negotiate new deals. Well, during the 19th century was the first time that nations began making trade agreements. And the example that might be in your book, I'm pretty sure is your book, is what they did in Germany. They would create what was known as the Zollverein, which simply means trade union. Germany was once made of 26 separate countries. And each one decided, rather than taxing each other to oblivion, we'll make trade-free zones. And if it wasn't for this, Germany never would have been unified in the years to come. Banks also emerged as players. Governments made laws to protect banking. The biggest one was the invention of what's known as the LLC, the Limited Liability Company. If any of you ever think about going into business yourself, organize your business as an LLC. That will basically put your business and separate it from you personally. So if someone tries suing the business, they can go after the business assets, but you'll be safe. Because you are just an employee of the business. Well, Belgium was the first company to give banks LLC protection. But the Industrial Revolution didn't spread globally. Nope, 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 nope. It was contained in Europe all the way up until the 1780s. Why? Well, because Europe got so far ahead of all of the other countries, most of the nations on the earth simply just became the suppliers of the resources. Now, FYI, I do talk about a period known as the era of new imperialism in global history, too. Because ultimately, it was this that caused the Europeans to become aggressive again. To conquer the rest of the globe. Because they wanted those resources to fill their industrial lusts. Now, some countries tried, like Russia. But Russia, which was primarily an agricultural producer, really was not able to industrialize until after the Bolshevik Revolution. And Egypt also tried. But the British ended up bankrupting Egypt and taking them over because England wanted Egypt to produce cotton, which, by the way, Egyptian cotton would replace American cotton. And plus, who doesn't like a nice bed covered in Egyptian cotton sheets? Oh, so nice and comfy. So, why did it not spread until the end of the 19th, early 20th century? All because of control. Europe monopolized industrial producing, flooded the markets with European goods, and nobody could compete. That's what I have on the Industrial Revolution. Questions? All right, we do not have class on Thursday. Thursday is Holy Thursday. to go home for Easter, eat lots of turkey, celebrate the return of our Lord and Savior, if you are so inclined. At the very least, talk lots of politics. That's what I plan on doing. Because my brother-in-law is a left-wing loon, and oh, I have so much fun. But also, don't forget, when we come back on Tuesday, papers are due. One person out of all of my students here has submitted their paper. Just one. That means a lot of you have a lot of work to do. Do not forget.
Have a safe and blessed Easter, and we'll see you next week.